This is the Theology Matters podcast. I'm your host, Josh Malden. I'm here today with co-host Andrew Davison from the University of Cambridge. And we're continuing this ongoing series on theology, on what theology is, its task, its purpose, its goals. And we have a very special guest today, Vincent Lloyd, who is an associate professor of theology and religious studies at Villanova University. He's the author of many books, including Black Natural Law, Race and Secularism in America. I could name many. Black Dignity, The Struggle Against Domination. Welcome to the podcast, Vincent.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just to start us off, you did your undergrad in religion, majored in religion here at Princeton. My first question for you is, how has that degree in religion as an undergraduate here influenced your later research, and particularly in theology?
Yes, that was really essential and formative for me. I think the way that religion was talked about at the department here at Princeton, where it's one of the few places where theology and religious studies are both treated seriously, both treated with respect, where diving into the ideas of the Christian tradition is seen as something that is a respectable part of intellectual work. But we should also be thinking critically about that tradition and about frameworks from across the humanities that are helpful in understanding religion and religious ideas and practices. And in addition to all of that, the combination of an orientation toward justice, both as an idea and as concrete practice in the world and at the university, paired with the sort of theological and religious studies orientation, I think that came together to shape me.
Going back even further than that, like, what made you have an interest in theology and religion, Lord of the studies?
So I guess I was something of a seeker as a young person. We moved from Michigan to Minnesota when I was 11, and for the first few months, each Sunday we would go to a different church, and was really curious about different religious traditions. My parents remember that I had all these little books, like for children, about learning about different traditions. So, you know, I think I had a general orientation in that direction. And then coming here to Princeton, I got involved in a living wage campaign, trying to raise the wages of dining hall workers and janitors and other low paid workers early on, and seeing the role of religion in motivating that movement. You know, both from participants, but also from allies, and then thinking about the way that, you know, I could devote my intellectual energies to bridging sort of, social justice movements and the sort of religious thought and practice was exciting to me.
Looking back over a number of your books, back to 2011, you wrote a book on the problem of grace. You got a book called Break Every Yoke, which is about abolition of prisons, Black Natural Law. Do you see your work as getting more theological over those years?
Well, I moved 8 years ago to Villanova University, to a Roman Catholic university, and to a department of theology and religious studies. Previously, I'd been teaching in secular religious studies contexts at secular both departments and institutions. I think being in a department where we have a nun and several priestess colleagues, right, as well as friends and colleagues from various religious traditions and commitments, has helped me think in new ways about my own sort of authorial voice and role in conversations around theology. That being said, from my dissertation, I was excited about, there's a chapter on John Milbank, there's a, wrote my dissertation on Gillian Rose, so thinking about the Christian reception of Gillian Rose, as well as a sort of secular philosophical reception of Gillian Rose, being a British social theorist who moved from sort of secular stance toward a Jewish stance toward a Christian stance, playing with ideas, both theological and secular, through that movement. I think I was grappling with those ideas from the very beginning.
I want to turn to Andrew for in a moment, but maybe one more question is just, you're an editor of the journal Political Theology, and I think you're very much, identified as a political theologian. How would you think about what political theology is and brought more broadly theology? We're talking about systematic theology, but we have a kind of broad definition of that. So however you want to approach theology is fine, but how do you think about what that the task of that field is?
We're also very happy to have you, Joshua, as part of the editorial team of the journal Political Theology. Yeah, so political theology is a term that people use loosely and in quite different contexts, from Christian theologians who are trying to say something about politics to secular political theorists who are reflecting on Carl Schmitt, to continental philosophers who are excited about Agamben, Foucault, and that tradition, to more recently anthropologists, literary scholars, historians who are sort of toying with the theological and seeing that as disruptive to the sort of secular frame of their inquiry, at least at the journal and in my sort of wearing an institutional hat. You know, we're trying to create a space where those different conversations can come together, where they can cross-pollinate, where we can explore what political theology at its best means when it's drawing on these multiple traditions rather than sort of putting forward a stance about what it ought to be. That's a bit different from your maybe the question about, you know, how does political theology sit in a context of systematic or constructive theology, which I think is also an open one, which I'm probably relatively agnostic on. You know, I think there are probably similar questions around liberation theology, you know, and the contingencies of institutional and disciplinary formation here. In my department, we have a Christian ethics unit and a systematic and constructive theology unit. And, you know, I sit in the Christian ethics unit and not the systematic unit. Which, you know, is a sort of contingency of our particular formation, but, you know, also makes sense in a particular particular way of seeing things.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the example of the Living Wage campaign, because it is such a good example of the role of religious communities and theological ideas in really making a difference, and something that now has taken off. It's the same story, I think, in the United Kingdom as the United States. It's really recognized as integral to the way in which all sorts of businesses and communities organize themselves, and it has these deeply cross-religious roots. I wanted to begin with a question about the Imago Dei, or image of God. From Black Dignity, your most recent book, I got the impression that you might describe the Imago Dei as a kind of a nice idea, but one that hasn't really lived up to its promise, that it belongs too much in the dominant intellectual status quo, which hasn't really proved itself able to do what one might hope morally or politically. But I think in earlier work, perhaps in Black Natural Law in particular, the image of God is more prominent. And so I wondered what you think we need to take from the idea of the image of God, and whether it is, after all, dispensable or, you know, useful. Well, I'll begin with those questions.
Thanks. Yes. So I should sort of preface this by saying Black Dignity was a book not written or marketed for an audience of theologians. It went through the political science line at its press and, you know, was trying to speak to and beyond the academy, sort of across disciplines, but, you know, toying with religious ideas. And of course, my formation within the theology religious studies context is, you know, is not something I can take off when I'm writing or engaging with the ideas around this. Yeah, I'm not sure if I would fully agree that Imago Dei sort of fades or recedes in this new work. You know, one of the sort of questions that I've been thinking through in both the Black Natural Law Project and in this Black Dignity Project is, you know, what does negative theology mean in the context of Christian ethics? I think negative theology is often a systematics question and not an ethics question, but it seems like it ought to be an ethics question. And one of the ways that I think we can start to answer that is by thinking about, you know, if part of what's distinctive about the human is the image of God in the human, and we are not very good about saying true things about God, right? There's something that exceeds the conceptual about God, then there's something that exceeds the conceptual about the human, right? And attempts to map the human into a conceptual terrain, or attempts to sort of speak rightly about the human, are always going to get something wrong. And if we can, and there's also a tendency of the human to slip away from, you know, these attempts to, in a sense, struggle against them, against any attempt to sort of pin down the human in a sort of conceptual in a conceptual framework. So, you know, what I was trying to do in the Black Dignity book was to, you know, really push that insight. So, you know, what is it about the image of God in the human that, you know, is ethically salient? Well, that there's, you know, it we're sort of participating in the divine when we're pushing against the systems of domination in the world that are trying to reduce us to the conceptual, reduce us to something that can be manipulated, reduce us to an object.
I think that's a really interesting move or mapping from the doctrine of God onto human beings. If I understand that right, then it's that if one had too neat a sense of what the image of God was, then it would stop doing its work. It would stop provoking us. It would stop disrupting our sinful propensities. That reminds me of Joseph Pieper, this German Thomist in the 20th century, who really drew out from Aquinas this idea that there's a kind of unfathomable depth to things because they come from God. So that's something then that the theologian should take back and think about. What else does your work pose to the theologian where maybe they've things have gone slack or there might need to be new thinking, new provocation on this area of God and human beings and the image of God?
Sure. So we've been talking from the doctrinal direction and now approaching from the opposite direction. That is, sort of sources of insight in the world for theological reflection. And you know, in this book, Black Dignity, another insight that I was trying to work with was a sense that if we look among communities of the marginalized, communities that are struggling against domination, we will find the best insight we have about the meaning of domination and about domination as a theological concept. I think this is a general theological insight, right? That the option for the poor is not just about helping out poor people, but about learning from mm-hmm. the experiences and wisdom of those who are marginalized, and not just because of their identity as marginalized, but because of the mechanisms of marginalization and response that are necessarily involved there. The sort of experiment in this book was to say, if we start with the language, the rhetoric that's swirling around a social justice movement, a black justice movement in the U.S., a Black Lives Matter movement, and take that as, a starting point for philosophical or theological reflection, how does that shift, the kind of theological and philosophical reflection we can do? Not taking that rhetoric as an ending point, not as a conversation stopper, but, as a kind of a source of inspiration and as something that we have to grapple with, even if we're going to argue with it.
You talk about attending to people and their situations, and that helps us to understand what oppression is. You go further and say that in the lives of people who are oppressed, we learn what humanity is. But I'm also struck in your work that you won't abandon the idea that all human beings share humanity, or even won't write off the humanity of those who do wrong. And I wonder, is that fair as a characterization? And also, has it been controversial?
Mm. Right. So I think that the thought here is that it's easy to think about domination, and particularly when it's abstracted into systems of domination, as something that those bad people do over there, or something that's sort of floating around above us and then affecting us. In fact, and I think this is central to the Christian story, right? We all dominate others. We all are dominated by others. We all participate in systems of domination. This isn't evenly distributed, right? Some people are horribly, grotesquely affected by systems of domination, and others horribly dominate others in abominable ways that we need to stop. We need to stop all domination, but then we need to especially attend to. I think that there is something tricky that sort of pushes against that embrace that's aligned with conventional wisdom, but that pushes against the sort of, political conversations of the day, right? When we say, all humans, have the complexity of experience in ourselves, and attending to that is essential for living together. So in one sense, I think that's uncontroversial. If we think about people we know and love, our family, friends, you know, neighbors, we know that they have parts of them that are, you know, dominating others, and other parts of them that are experiencing the effects of domination, and so on. But when the conversation moves to the abstract, right, and moves to the distant, as it does on social media and on news and, you know, these sorts of popular discourses, then we forget about that uncontroversial insight.
Hmm. There's this idea there that dignity comes, and you describe it as black dignity, comes from the context of resisting oppression and domination. And I think this is probably my trickiest question, is how does one say that and get away from the idea that somehow domination is necessary for the sake of dignity? How can one describe dignity as arising in the context of resisting oppression in a way that doesn't, in a certain sense, risk making the domination necessary?
Yes, yeah. So this is a parallel question to one about suffering, right, in the world, sort of a systematic theological question about suffering in the world or evil or something, right? There's, well, maybe not evil, suffering. Right. So, I mean, I think I do want to, sort of embrace our situatedness in a sort of between times, right? In a time where, we're not yet at the eschatological horizon. We're not in Eden, right? We're in a messy world, and you know, there's possibilities to be oriented toward the good, the true, and the beautiful, but there are also forces of domination and false gods that are all around us, and. So to fill out the meaning of dignity in these between times, right, in this messy world, I don't think it's I think we go wrong if we imagine we can find dignity in a kind of stillness, in a kind of isolation, in a I think the only way to fill out the meaning of dignity is as it unfolds in grappling with the messiness of this world, and particularly in orienting ourselves toward the true and against false gods. I don't know if that responds fully to your question.
I think that does, and it's about not letting ourselves off by too easy anticipations.
Exactly, yes.
And you mentioned their false gods, and I'm struck also by the way in which idolatry features in your work. And I wonder how, as an example of the way in which you are all the time engaging with people for whom theology and religion is not a natural context, does the language of idolatry ring true? Do you find that that's a bridge or an opportunity for a conversation with people who wouldn't naturally think in theological categories, or we might say wouldn't maybe naturally realize that they are thinking in terms of theological categories?
Thanks. Yeah. So I suppose there are a couple of categories of these other people out there in the world who are not listening to our theology podcast. But one category is sort of secular academics who have an allergy to the theological language, and for them, I'm not sure how. I mean, perhaps in some context, the language of idolatry, when it's sort of sanitized, is okay. But if we can articulate the way that idolatry and ideology are getting at something similar, right, are about ideas of elites that are disguising themselves as absolute and everlasting. And then sort of filtering down into the world, I think that sort of pathway from idolatry to a sort of secular critical theory is productive. But for the other group of people, that is, for sort of people out in the world outside of the academy, I think this sense of false gods is very is quite intuitive. And even thinking just in this Black American case of police officers who think too highly of themselves. Right? What are they doing? They're thinking of themselves as a false god in some sense, right? They're taking the power of life and death into their own hands. They're taking their own sense of truth to trump the truth of others. And we can understand how there's something deeply wrong about that. And the language of idolatry, I think, is getting at that.
And I think it maps back onto your idea of apophaticism and negative theology, that anything that we too easily describe as God, or any sense of having a handle on God, or God who can be made to do our bidding, is susceptible to the critique of idolatry and the critique of apophaticism. It's almost the same thing, really.
Along those lines, I was also thinking about your critique of secularism. You kind of gestured at it, but I wanted to speak more about it. And in particular, from your 2017 book published by Fordham, The Religion of the Black, Religion of the Field Negro, Black Secularism and Black Theology, you have a nice introduction there where you really talk about the task of theology. And your critique of secularism, I feel like I learned a lot from it. Although you're also, because you're talking about how theology itself can often buy into the norms of secularism and thereby kind of give up its birthright or something like that. It's kind of a Bardian take to some extent. You talk about the impossibility of doing theology and speaking of God as impossible, but nevertheless has to be done. Maybe speak to that. Say a bit about what your critique of secularism is and what it means for what theology should be, what Black theology should be. It's also a critique particularly of Black secularism, as you call it. Maybe speak to that.
Sure. And again, I think there's some very intuitive moves here, right? That there's a mystery in the human, a mystery in the world that we need to attend to, that we can't ignore. And also that there are people in the world and people with power in the world who want to ignore that mystery. And in fact, one of the ways in which people retain power is by blinding us to the sites of mystery, sites of paradox, right? That are inside of us and around the world. So that's one way of getting to this sort of question of secularism as a kind of dogmatic rejection of the inexplicable, right? That which is beyond the sort of logic or reasoning that we find around us in the world, articulates in one way in terms of managing religious commitments, or saying religious commitments are not allowed in this space, but it articulates. In other ways, it articulates through exclusion of religious commitments. It articulates through the management of religious convictions, saying, only religion that looks a certain way, right, that's understandable within the logic of the world, only that kind of religion is allowed in this space, which isn't actually a religion at all, at least, or isn't really a theological tradition at all, if the transcendent, right, the mysterious has been taken away from it. I think it also articulates sort of culturally in, for example, around political issues where the conversation is limited to the options that seem plausible, the options that you can put on the table, the policy prescriptions that, someone can write a white paper on and then you sort of choose between the three options. I think that kind of framework for solving problems in the world and for seeing the world, that is, as a series of problems that can be solved by choosing between the three options that have been developed through right reasoning. Now, I think there's something very dangerous about that, very damaging about that, and that is deeply tied to secularism, to the refusal of mystery and paradox and the transcendent. So that maybe that addresses the first part of your question. The second part of your question was about how that connects specifically with questions of race and Black experience in the U.S. context. I think there's something sort of tricky about this, in that one of the stereotypes of Black American experience is excessive religiosity or a sort of natural religiosity, natural spirituality. There's been, I think this is both intuitive and there's scholarship around this. Curtis Evans has a wonderful book called The Burden of Black Religion, tracking these various ways in which these stereotypes have been applied over centuries to Black American religious experience. But that caricature of Black religiosity is also a form of management of Black religiosity, right? It's a form of forcing the complexity of Black religious traditions and practices that are embedded in those traditions and communities that are sustaining those traditions, forcing all of that richness and complexity into, you know, a particular image that is produced by a white society or white majority society that's trying to hold on to power and pursue its own interests. So one of the things that I try to do in that book that you referred to is, you know, I think through how theological projects within Black theology themselves can self-orientalize, that is, buy into these caricatures that are made of Black religion from the outside, rather than critically engaging with the tradition of Black Christianity in its richness.
Yeah, I was reading that even in a self-critical way, I have to say, because, you know, this podcast is called Theology Matters, and I think there's always a tendency that we're trying to kind of think about where are the real world impacts and so on of theological ideas. And I took you to be, it was kind of helping me think through that some ways that can hamper theology, to always be thinking, you know, how does this solve this crisis in the world or that crisis? Or, but maybe by doing that, you're actually undermining the very value of what theology is.
I think we need to be able to do two things at once, right? Which is something people are not very good at, right? Doing two things at once, right? Thinking in practical terms, thinking about impact, thinking about community building, but also, right, thinking about the transcendent in all of its mystery and grandeur.
Is this a point where John Milbank's thinking has been significant for you? You mentioned him earlier on.
Yeah, so I as an undergraduate reading theology and social theory, I think that was formative for my orientation toward the study of religion and theology, and the kind of critical questions that I ask when I'm reading secular texts as well as theological texts. I'm not going to like every tweet of John Milbank, but you know the general orientation I think is one that we still need in the academy to be grappling with.
You mentioned a moment ago the idea of holding two things together or thinking two things at once. And I'm struck that you've written books exploring law and grace, and that in some Christian traditions, perhaps the Lutheran tradition particularly, they have a strongly antithetical relationship. In others, maybe Reformed Christianity, Catholicism, law and grace are both important, but grace is... has the last word, I suppose. Was there something deliberate in writing a book about those two? And having written about both, what is your understanding of the relation between law and grace?
Yeah, so this strikes me as the question at the heart of the Christian tradition. How do you articulate law and grace together? The question at the heart of the how Christians are to live, right? How law and grace are to be articulated together. Right. And I think it often, so taking a step back, the reason that this, one of the reasons that this question interests me is because I think, there is a kind of, there's an answer to that question that migrates into secular culture, that makes an easy separation between law and grace, which is often mapped onto a kind of supersessionism. You know, there was once this law of these other people that we then can set aside because, you know, in this political or cultural context now, we have a new dispensation. We, you know, can fill in the details there. What initially interested me was this migration from the theological context of supersessionism to the secular context in culture and politics and questions of race in various ways as well. And then I also started thinking about the next move, that is a migration back from secular culture, right? If this supersessionism now is this cultural phenomenon of how people in a secular context think about the relationship between law and grace as too easy, too simplistic, too neatly divided, and, you know, authorizing a kind of hubris, you know, from the standpoint of grace with respect to law, then how does that migrate back into theological spaces? How does that contaminate sort of Christian theological reflection in various ways or in various traditions. So that's a big question, and one I'm still just starting to think about in various ways. Right. I mean, I think that these two things are essential and fit together in some way, and these two things, not just in their narrowest sense, that is sort of biblical sense of here are the 10 things you're supposed to do, and now you can forget about them. But in their normativity as such, right, the sense that there's a set of things that of obligations and compulsion obligations and oughts, that are sort of structuring our world, law in this broad sense, and grace, right, as a sort of a suspension of that, tied to all sorts of things, including emotional life as opposed to rational life. Grappling with how those things fit together, it seems like a big question, the question, and one I'm still thinking through.
I wanted to move on to a piece that you've written on the curriculum that I read online and found helpful. And you talk about your students sometimes being resistant to taking a step back and looking at theological texts. That might also apply to philosophical and political texts, but I think here theology is in mind. And one of the things we've wanted to do on this podcast has been to commend theology to the church, really, and say sometimes the church is at risk of forgetting this great treasure that it has. And here you're writing in a university setting and saying, yeah, sometimes we've got to take a step back and put in a bit of hard work and read some texts. And I was wondering if there's anything from the classroom and the integration of theology within a political and ethical frame that might help us in our job of commending theology and saying it is actually worth reading this stuff also to the church.
Thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I myself have more questions than answers when it comes to teaching well or the classroom, but just a couple observations. So an initial observation is that teaching at a Augustinian Catholic institution, you would think that students would come in primed to immerse themselves in the complexities of tradition, when in fact that's not the case. The Catholic students are very Protestant in their outlook and very secular in their outlook and in their reading of texts. And in their thinking about authority and ethics and so on. I think that, reintroducing students to what it means to read a text carefully and read a text as part of a tradition and see tradition as something that is not a set of rules that you then apply to your life, but is something that is dynamic and robust and involves the lives of the saints and involves things that go wrong and involves, transformations in light of social conditions and so on. That seems like a big task to me, and one that, I think students can get excited about, right? Because, first of all, that I think there's a kind of pleasure to pulling back the curtain, right? You thought in high school that religion was about this, but actually, right? If you see the complexities involved, right? That you have a certain kind of special knowledge. So I think that's one avenue of success. But I think just in a technology saturated culture, putting away computers and phones for a while, sitting with a few pages of text, reading line by line, and struggling together, as a class, as a seminar, with what is the author saying here? How is it challenging our expectations? How is it challenging the wisdom of the world? I think it doesn't take long in doing that to see that whether or not that's something that students embrace and want to do for the rest of their lives. But I think that they can at least see that there's something there that they're not getting elsewhere.
And if you don't mind giving away trade secrets, are there any texts that you've found that are quite good for drawing that curtain back?
Thanks. Yeah. No. I'm a big fan of teaching James Cone's Black Theology work in that I think it's so surprising to students, right? That you can do things with theology that didn't seem possible, right? And there are things that are in dialogue with the tradition. They're in dialogue with Karl Barth. They're in dialogue with Paul Tillich. They're in dialogue with church fathers in certain ways. And yet they're also clearly political. They're also cultural interventions. There's a theoretical sophistication there. But it's sort of growing out of and picking up on a Christian language and Christian tradition. So that's one example.
I think it's quite helpful when students come across theology and they just find it more beautiful than they expected. Mm-hmm. And Josh and I sometimes talk about things that we've been reading and about how it sometimes just stops us in our tracks. I was reading mm-hmm. some Barth a week before last on the bit where he's talking about the way in which God speaks beyond the Bible and beyond the church. Mm-hmm. I think it's called The Light of Life. And I did laugh out loud occasionally a few times in Princeton Theological Seminary Library because it was just so arresting and unexpected and beautiful. Is the beautiful in the midst of all this suffering and oppression, is there something about the beauty in the text that is important?
I think that's tricky when we're talking about translating that into the classroom, because I think there can be something very frustrating about taking a text that you find beautiful,
yes, right?
And then sharing it with people who aren't, maybe who have the capacity to find it beautiful, but the work to do to move from that latent capacity to actually finding it beautiful is a lot, and there's a lot of disappointment on the instructor's part, right? if the senses of beauty don't match. I think that as an ideal, reading together beautiful texts is wonderful.
But something you say in that article, I think really responds to that practically, which was that you said you left some time at the end of the course for the students to bring the texts to the course that had spoken to them or that they thought was significant. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's a good way of getting around this question of why didn't you find it beautiful? Because you're letting them do the work and not filtering for them in advance what they're supposed to find useful or beautiful or helpful. That's a risky position, I think, to leave part of the curriculum open like that. But I might take it back to Cambridge with me.
Okay.
And talking about texts, what do you think the systematic theologian ought to be reading?
Thanks. Yeah, that's a big question. My temptation is to say that it's over my pay grade because I'm in the Christian Ethics Unit at Villanova, not in the Systematics and Constructive Unit at Villanova. I think I find things the most valuable that are experimental and that are engaging with various forms of critical theory, cultural studies in the humanities, but also engaging with the canon or the tradition of the theological world in various ways. Jonathan Tran's work on Asian Americans in the Spirit of Racial Capitalism, I think, is a nice example of that sort of experimental stance. And I would read it as experimental rather than as sort of a sort of set position that he's putting forward there. I think Lynn Tonstad's work is really interesting in that respect as well, particularly the essays that she's been writing recently, where she's deeply grounded in von Balthasar and in the sort of canonical 20th century Christian theology, but is also thinking with gender theory and queer theory, and trying to think about how these things fit together, ways of thinking about the emotions or temporality that are bubbling up in secular cultural studies might help us think in new ways about these same topics within the Christian tradition.
You talked there about some quite creative work. And one of the things that we've liked to talk about on this podcast, and particularly this series, is whether theology can be written in styles or genres. It can almost kind of look different on the page than it has done traditionally. And I wonder whether you have any reflections there about if theology almost literally looks different in the 21st century in terms of the way people are laying it out on the page or the genres they're exploring.
Yes. So I think I'm a little bit hesitant to say strong things about this because I'm the sort of person who sort of thinks poetry is interesting, but it doesn't have any, it feels like I'm incompetent to sort of judge it. So I feel like sometimes with experiments with a genre, I find them interesting, but I also feel like my capacity to judge is somewhat limited. And I also see it go wrong very badly. It seems like there's a corner of the theological world that tries to be very experimental with form and genre and ends up replicating sort of liberal theological conventions and conventional wisdom, but just looking slightly different, which, you know, I have a particular allergy to doing. I was on the right over here listening to a new book on Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement, and you know, the experiments with genre, in a sense, that one finds Catholic Worker newspaper in the writings of Dorothy Day seem like an interesting experiment. Like, what does that mean to count that as systematic theology?
Maybe that my problem is even to think that the 21st century is turning a page in any of this, because, as you say, it was there at the beginning of the 20th or earlier in the 20th. And if we asked our forebears about poetry and hymnody and so on, they probably would just see it as part of the theological whole anyway.
Well, we usually end with a few quick questions. You want to go to those, Andrew? Or
Sounds
do you have
good.
A few more? And you've kind of gestured at some of these, but they're maybe ask a few more. What would be one book that was most formative for you in theology?
I think reading John Milbank's Theology and Social Theory along with Religious Studies Canon across the street there at Princeton University was formative.
Was this mainly with Eric Gregory or Jeff Stout or both?
I was thinking Jeff Stout's Introduction to the Study of Religion class, and then on my own reading Milbank.
And if when you teach a theology class, what's a text that you think any theology student has to encounter?
So I think it does depend on the context, but Enrique Dussel recently passed, and I happened to be teaching Enrique Dussel the day before or the day after he passed. It may be in the future that Enrique Dussel becomes such a figure for me.
And two more. One is, what are you reading right now? Well, you just told us what you're reading, listening to, but maybe what's on your nightstand? And then final one is, what are you working on next?
Yeah, so I'm reading some of this new Anne Pellegrini book on gender without identity, which is sort of thinking through questions of trans queer and gender theory, and trying to think with that about how it could be a resource for theological reflection on questions of identity beyond gender, race, and class, and so on. What I'm working on next, I'm in the sort of theological world. I have a couple of collaborative projects, one with Luke Bretherton and Valentina Napolitano, an anthropologist. So thinking about what is political theology, that's the title of the book. So we each have sort of a chapter there thinking about how we distinctively approach political theology. It's a big, longer-term project. It's about abuse, the concept of abuse, and how the different registers of abuse can be brought together through a kind of theological imagination.
Well, thanks so much, Vincent, for being on the podcast and for joining us today in the studio here at CTI. And you've written so much, but we will at least commend your book, most recent book, Black Dignity, The Struggle Against Domination, published by Yale University Press. So thanks so much, Vincent.
Thanks for having me.